ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to the latest episode of the Attention Please podcast, and this is your host Arnab Ray with all the things this week that are worth discussing. I said all the things that are worth discussing, and I'm beginning with Raj Kundra. So why should I be left behind, given that all news channels and everybody else is discussing Raj Kundra as if this is the most important thing that's going on in India today? Of course, it is the most entertaining thing that's going on in India today. I mean, what could be more explosive than porn, or let's say the trace of porn, more than porn, and I'll come to that. A dash of Bollywood, though I struggle to call Raj Kundra Bollywood. Yes, I know he is married to Shilpa Shetty, but still, it is a stretch. And so before we get to this, this has, of course, been, as I said, an absolute godsend for Arnab Goswami and his ilk, because this is their bread and butter. They're two kinds of bread and butter topics. It's like Ravi Shastri's chapati shop that they love to go back. And there's kind of monotone at this point of time. If those of you who are old enough to remember Ravi Shastri back, he had basically two modes. One was ultra defense, where the monotony of his batting would be broken by his chapati shot, which is a flick if somebody was stupid enough to pitch the delivery outside his leg stump, he would be on it. And the other was he would just stride out two steps and try to hit a six. And there was that's it, these were the only two gears that he had to his batting. And that's, unfortunately, most of news masquerading as entertainment masquerading as news. Most of it is like that. It's monotone or duotone. So one is Pakistan and Islamic terrorism is one of them, one of these bread and butter shots. And the other is the sins of anti-national Bollywood. So these two things are, you know, you can always count on these to get you eyeballs. And now we have Raj Kundra and his porn business. And everything about this is perfect in terms of the amount of entertainment it provides. And I don't know if any of you have seen any of this. I did watch through a few hours of it. And it was essentially the dominating thing is each of these news channels, the way they present the news, it reminds me very much of the message of Hindi's very, very soft quote stuff that we used to watch growing up. It was that porn is terrible. While the message was that porn was terrible and all of this, the whole thing was to show as much of skin as they could. So this, you know, when you turn on the television, you'd see that while the voice at the back is intoning as to how terrible this is and the edge of the moral cliff that we are standing on, there are pictures, and depending on how big your TV screen is, that's really what dominates your living room, are pictures of, you know, Sherilyn Chopra doing a photo shoot wearing a bikini, or, you know, Poonam Pandey. That's really exactly what those TV channels are kind of using as a way to not get people to change the channel. Or, you know, when you're surfing through the channel and you immediately come to that, that's when your channel, your hand basically freezes on the button. So this is exactly what they're doing. And the irony, of course, is they're blaming Raj Kundra for doing exactly that. And this is something which I find monumentally hypocritical. First of all, this is not a defense of Raj Kundra as a business person. So if you follow Raj Kundra, you'll find that he's been involved with multiple, I would say, sleazy business ventures. And so this is really who he is. And Raj Kundra is really not a significant person in India, unless, of course, this makes it. This is what brings him, gives him that significance. And what I understand, what he was doing was he was basically this hotshot And I think one of the quotes that I remember seeing early on was Mika, who's possibly the expert on these things, saying that, you know, he reviewed the app and there was really nothing much to it. And I think I understand what he's trying to say, given the amount and the strength of undiluted sulfuric acid that's present on the net. This is a highly, highly diluted version of that, which is freely available. So why is there a business in this kind of porn? Well, again, I read somewhere, this was not porn, this was erotica. I'm not even getting into that debate here. That's the topic for another day. But moving to the side, the thing is that besides, of course, the gratuitous moral outrage, while showing the exact same things that Raj Kundra was trying to monetize, besides the monumental hypocrisy in that, the other hypocrisy is this hypocrisy that many of us have towards, let's say, erotic content. I'm 100% sure that if we looked at all those television, all those people on the screen, those little, you know, of 10 by 10 or 16 by 16 boxes that they all have on the TV screen, if they suddenly went and we went home and looked at what they have on their laptop and what they have immediately on their cell phones, I'm pretty sure we would find things that Raj Kundra was beyond what Raj Kundra was providing on the app. So the hypocrisy of this is absolutely monumental, that while everybody and their uncles watch porn. And of course, when people get caught, they say, you know, my account was hacked. And yes, Waqar Yunus, I'm looking at you. So there's this entire hypocrisy that, okay, everybody watches porn in this day and age because it's just so freely available. I'm pretty sure people would have watched it also when we were growing up, because I remember when I was growing up, the amount of effort that I had to put in order to get, I wouldn't call it porn by the standards of today, but let's say, you know, pictures of Pamela Anderson or Cindy Crawford. It was not because that I was, or my generation were particularly, moral, but it was that we just didn't have access to it. It was just impossible to get access to. Given that the access is ubiquitous in today's day and age, the entire hypocrisy, and who produces that? Who provides that? People like Raj Kundra, right? And most people have absolutely no problem in consuming that product. But the moment the person behind it comes out, and oh, it happens to be Raj Kundra, of course, everybody is shocked and everybody tries to get on this really, really high moral ground. And that to me is perhaps the bigger hypocrisy. I honestly don't expect anything other than hypocrisy from Arnab Goswami, Republic TV, Rajdeep Sardesai, and the ilk. I honestly don't. So it's kind of flogging a dead horse coming to that. They're also, I would say, an easy target for me and people like me is to make Indian commercial media to be their target. That's also a fairly easy target. But the perhaps more interesting thing is this social media outrage I read from people as if they don't see porn on WhatsApp groups and stuff, as if all of these people, they are, you know, paragons of virtue. And by the way, I don't even think of this as virtue by any sense of the term. The way I stand, if it's consenting adults who are performing, and it's consenting adults who are benefiting from it, and consenting adults who are consuming it, then I think it's perfectly fine in this day and age, and at any point of time. As long as they're adults and as long as they're consenting all across the board, I really don't think it is anybody's business. Now, people will say, but porn is illegal in India, so that's why he's being prosecuted. And I totally get that. It is illegal in India. I don't know why it is illegal in India, but it is illegal in India. I don't have to buy into everything. I understand that the country's laws don't have to obey my sense of what's right and wrong, and that countries have the right to keep laws that comport with or are consistent with the majority what the majority thinks is right and wrong. So I believe I'm in the minority in this case in terms of my attitude towards porn, but I don't think that I'm in the minority when it comes to, you know, say in terms to, let's say, what's on my laptop kind of thing. I don't think that's where I am. I'm pretty sure that I am in, everybody does it. And, you know, that's why porn has always been a billion-dollar business. As I read somewhere that it's the technology adoption is driven by the porn industry, whether it was Betamax versus VHS, whether it was streaming on net, whether it was credit card payments for e-commerce, everything. The leading edge was always porn. So what I'm trying to say is that in the early days of the 90s, when e-commerce was just a nascent and people were like, why? People were just scared of providing their credit cards. There was very little security. There was very little regulations. There was just, so it was a weird thing to do. And how did all of this start? People just didn't want to buy things online. What made it normal for people? What reduced their resistance to providing their credit card online was porn. I read that a few years ago. So it's not that the porn industry hasn't had, I would say, a beneficial effect on the way the world is today. So that's also not true, because you know what, you might be a little, you know, hesitant providing a credit card for buying a book online, but or buying groceries online, but you might not be that hesitant when it is paradoxically, and perhaps not really paradoxically, for dishing it out for porn. But again, the hypocrisy around this for me is stupendous. And I'm while I understand the hypocrisy, I also feel fit to condemn it. But coming back to this whole Raj Kundra thing, what exactly was he doing? And what I understand is that he had an app, and it was just not one thing that he was doing. One of the things about these businesses, they have multiple fronts and multiple, let's say, parallel threads, so that when one of them is shut down or one of them gets discovered, they have other avenues in which they can tap into the market. Yes, I know. So Hotshots, from what I understand, is essentially a desi version of OnlyFans. For those of you who don't know or claim not to know what OnlyFans is, OnlyFans is really Patreon for people who produce adult content. So there are a lot of people who use this, and of course OnlyFans takes a cut. So you pay a monthly fee and you get to message the adult content creator. And this is exactly what Raj Kundra was trying to do. And I was in a WhatsApp group where somebody had this conversation, where somebody asked, well, why does anybody pay for porn in this day and age where there's so much of it is available for free, so much of adult content is available for free? And the answer to that is essentially is with these kinds of app-based the reason why people pay is that it provides people a connection with the producer of the adult content. So they get to send messages, they get to feel as if they know this person. And that is what people pay for, more than the content per se, which, yes, true, that the content is pretty much available for free online. So what they're actually paying for is the connection, is the fact that there's somebody who's listening at the other end of the line. That's really what people are paying for. And even in this, this is not just OnlyFans. There are many dating apps and, you know, adult social media apps which essentially follow the same model. And what Raj Kundra was trying to do was, again, where the real USP is the personal connect. He perhaps rightfully gauged that there is a scope for an India-focused, India-themed app where the personal connect will obviously be Indians to Indians. So I think that was really what his Steve Jobs idea was. Of course, what's happened to him is kind of different from what happened to Steve Jobs, in the sense he doesn't, not going to be remembered for being a visionary. He is, I also don't feel that there's nothing's going to happen to him per se in India. All that he can be accused of, and this is not the first time he's been accused of it, is just being a cutthroat businessman and, you know, of playing, you know, fast and loose with the with Indian laws. And again, he's not the first one and he's not the only one. The point is, there is this enormous hypocrisy around adult content and around porn, and this thing, this shock, and how could he, is like, dude, please. And then, of course, add to it the fact that you have people, you have news channels who are the soundtrack is about outrage, but the visual track is essentially mimicking the Hot Shots app in terms of using the exact same way to catch eyeballs and in order to catch attention. And that, to me, is also monumentally hypocritical. So moving on to the next story for today, which is about Pegasus and overall ransomware as a service. So for those of you who, just a brief context about what the news is. So Pegasus is an Israeli firm which sells a surveillance software to governments. That's really what it claims. So the surveillance software has been linked allegedly to, you know, surveillance of political dissidents and media personalities across the world. Allied with it, and this is really the angle that I wanted to talk about more in this podcast, is also ransomware as a service. So ransomware as a service is not surveillance. And what happens in ransomware is that a hacker or a bad guy, they break into your system and then they encrypt your data and say, look, we are going to, you're not going to be able to get access to your data. So in your case, let's say you have pictures of your children and you have like memories, they'll go in, they'll encrypt all of that and say, if you want your memories back, you'll have to pay us so-and-so amount of money in Bitcoin. And once you do that, we will give you the decryption key. So this is, again, a variation of an old attack on computers that used to be called Schmidt fraud. So in Schmidt fraud, what used to happen was that, and this was, Schmidt fraud was very prevalent in the days of Windows XP, when things could be downloaded onto your computer without you explicitly authorizing it. This doesn't happen so much nowadays, but it was like rampant during Windows XP days. So what happened in Schmidt fraud was that you would get a pop-up, and that was the first sign of the malware, that the malware was already onto your computer, where the pop-up would basically say that you have been infected with this virus. And in order to get rid of the virus, you need to call this number or you need to download this this tool which will clean the virus. And of course, if the tool that you downloaded or the people that you paid were the people who put the quote unquote malware there in the first place. And that's exactly how it would work. So essentially it was holding your computer to ransom. So what would happen is they would change the background of your computer. They would prevent you from doing anything. They would disable your Control-Alt-Del. So they would do, and they technically had the power to, you know, look at where you're putting your mouse. They basically had control of your computer. So this used to be called Schmidt fraud. And now what they do is, it's, of course, it's been ramped up. So now what they do is, it's not just personal computers and people's personal data that's under attack. It's mostly corporate data, because they obviously can get more money. It's healthcare data, because if you can encrypt or destroy let's say, a chemotherapy, multiple sessions of chemotherapy, you basically put the life of the patient in danger. So that means the data is worth much more than what it, you know, what you could get on somebody's laptop in, you know, 2010. So this is, but again, this is what it is, really. But the point that I'm trying to stress over here is an interesting thing that I have noted is that beforehand, what used to happen is that whether it be ransomware or whether it be surveillance, spyware, it was always that the people who developed were the people who actually used these things. But now increasingly we find that it has almost become corporatized in the sense that the guys who provide the tools and the guys who use the tools are totally different entities. And the guys who produce these tools essentially separate themselves from the execution of this. So what they're going to say is, look, we are not illegal. We are just merely providing the tools for somebody to commit an illegal act. Of course, that's not the way they'll present it. So the whole notion of ransomware as a service is that I am, let's say, a software developer. So 5 years ago, if I wanted to be a digital extortionist, I would have to create my ransomware. Then I would need to figure out a way to get it onto my target. I would take the Bitcoin payment, and that would be the way I would make my money. But now, because many people have realized that, hey, many good software developers don't directly want to be the people executing the criminal act. Now, of course, this is hypocrisy to the highest level, because you are basically providing the tools for a criminal to execute their act, but that provides them a level of indirection from the actual crime being committed. So it's almost virtually impossible to prosecute people who do ransomware attacks, principally for two reasons. It's because they sit in countries where the governments essentially support them, and that they're kind of immune from prosecution. And that's the fun of digital crime, is that there's no national boundary. You can attack anybody from anywhere, which is not the case from, let's say, a bank robbery. So that just makes it, but even then, there are companies which want to separate themselves from the execution of these illegal or, let's say, morally ambiguous acts. And that, I think, is fairly interesting and a fairly recent development. So whether it be ransomware as a service or surveillance tech as a service, the people who are producing this, or providing this, they will say, we just sell licenses to our software. And we don't care what the people who buy this licenses do with these licenses. Of course, they also have, these guys also try to show some ethics. So they say, look, we don't sell to these guys. We don't sell to these guys. Oh yeah, right. Exactly. As if you know who you're selling to, as if those guys are actually sending you a banker's check. They're paying you with Bitcoin too. Okay. So, you know, spare us that. So this was as somebody who's interested in cybersecurity, and that's really what, you know, for those of you who know me, that's really my day job. It's interesting to see how the business model of criminal enterprise on the interwebs is changing, in the sense that this kind of separation of concerns is now coming in. Now coming to Pegasus, and of course, this, oh my goodness, how can they do this? It's almost as if people pretend to be so naive that they don't know that governments have always done surveillance. And it used to be very easy to do surveillance, because all you needed to do was, you know, control the telephone exchange, which most governments always had access to the telephone exchange. Now, these days, what's happened is actually things are better in many ways, because messaging apps and the proliferation of encryption allows the individual to have the kind of tools and technologies in their hands that, you know, governments cannot break unless they use things like Pegasus. So in a way, things are better now. And I was looking at news and the Ravish kinds who always want to portray, and this unfortunately the liberals don't consider to be fake news. They always want to portray this as something which is absolutely no new and the thin end of the wedge. It's just that previously when surveillance was going on, it was going on people who they were ideologically opposed to. So I think they were fine with that. So this entire thing that surveillance never used to happen or was limited is absolutely untrue. If anything, surveillance was much more pervasive before than it is now. Because even with something as sophisticated as Pegasus, it's much easier and absolutely deterministic. If you are as a government and you are landlines, you can always listen. 100% you can always listen to any conversation. There's nothing anybody can do, whether it be landline or whether it be conventional cell phone services. So with Pegasus, there is this kind of very sophisticated surveillance tech, true, but there is always this concept of a zero-day vulnerability. So what's a zero-day vulnerability? So a zero-day vulnerability is essentially a vulnerability in any application which the developers do not know exists and which these hackers have quote-unquote figured out. So it is really a hole in the wall that nobody is aware of, that these guys are aware of. Now, in applications like WhatsApp or Messenger, these things are extremely difficult to find. I'm not saying they don't exist. Obviously, they do. But these things are very difficult to find because the companies that make them are, you know, have a lot of money. They have a lot of good staff. And they do put these apps through the cybersecurity ringer to ensure that zero-day vulnerabilities don't exist. So just as a point of comparison between the, let's say, an app that you download off the app store that you don't like, which tells you what your horoscope is, versus let's say WhatsApp, you can be absolutely 100% sure that the WhatsApp has gone through way, way more cybersecurity testing and way, way more oversight. However, it is still zero-day vulnerabilities exist. And as a cybersecurity person, I have to applaud the ingenuity of, you know, cyber criminals, because they do consistently find these zero-day vulnerabilities. And these zero-day vulnerabilities are, you know, it costs upwards of million to many millions of dollars on the black market once somebody finds these. So these are extremely, extremely rare and extremely, extremely valuable. So what happens is that these companies are now essentially farming these zero-day vulnerabilities. So it's essentially, I mean, it's fascinating how hacking or surveillance have kind of become, there's almost a supply chain to it. So these companies buy zero-day vulnerabilities from individual hackers on the black market in the dark web through Bitcoin. They sell them and then they resell them. So then they take these vulnerabilities, they have their own tools that they have developed, which these tools are user-friendly fronts to. So when the original level zero hacker finds a zero-day vulnerability, that person is not interested in how you're going to use that vulnerability. That person just demonstrates what the vulnerability is and creates a proof of concept in terms of code, which shows, yes, this vulnerability can be exploited to do this thing. Now they sell this to the next level, who then take this and create a user-friendly wrapper around it, so that now it can be used by the criminals, who again will not have that level of sophistication. So it is put into, it has a user interface, it has tutorials, it has ways to use it, in which they essentially take it, they package it, they weaponize it. And this is where the irony is, using some of the tools that are used by penetration testers and the good hackers to test your systems. So the exact same tools that are used to test your systems are adapted to now do evil to your systems. So then they go and sell it to the governments or sell it to cyber criminals, who are the people who actually execute the target. So these companies don't know who's targeting, and they don't want to know, actually. This is they will not want to know, because they don't want that criminal liability that comes with it. And the guys who they bought it from of the dark web, well, they're two levels behind. So this allows for, this provides much greater protection to every link in the chain than previously it was possible. Now, again, I had written a fairly detailed deconstruction of Pegasus as well as some of these ransomware as a service attacks on LinkedIn, and I had shared it on Twitter. But essentially, the way it works, for those of you who haven't read it or don't have the patience to read it, the way your cell phone gets quote unquote hacked, and I'm trying to be as non-technical as possible, is that, so in any kind of system, there is, just think of it as two levels of privilege. There are many ways, levels of privilege. I'm just trying to simplify this discussion. So there is the privilege of your operating system, which is really all access pass. So the operating system can do everything. The operating system is responsible for ensuring that your applications that you download, your apps to the app store, that they don't do bad things to each other because you can't trust them. So your operating system is fundamentally trusted by your cell phone. Your applications are not. Your applications are presumed that, you know, who knows what's going on in the application. So your applications are not to be trusted. Now, so there are things known as sandboxing, which essentially means that the operating system, when you download, let's say, app A and app B, app A does not know anything about what app B is doing. So app A can't look into the memory space. So there are lots of these protections which are enforced by the operating system. But remember, the operating system is inherently trusted, which means that the operating, getting into the operating system is really what the attacker is trying to do. Because once it can get into the operating system, that's when it has control over all the applications. But it's very difficult to get into the operating system because if I just said that apps go through a very high level of testing and high level of security overview, well, guess what? The operating system goes through orders of magnitude more because of its trusted nature, the kind of security, cybersecurity review, and they're produced by Apple, they're produced by Google. So of course, they have very, very good engineers who do this. So what tools like Pegasus do is that they essentially, first of all, they have a zero-day vulnerability, one or more zero-day vulnerabilities into apps that are being used. So the way people get into systems is usually through the apps. They can't directly hit your operating system. So how do they get into your apps? So one very easy way of getting in through your apps is getting you to click on a malicious link that then downloads things into your memory. So in the memory space of the app through which you click the link. In some cases, there are zero-day vulnerabilities within the app itself. So once that happens, your attacker has a toehold at the application level. Mind you, that the attacker cannot look into other apps. All the attacker has done is injected its slimy little paws into an application. So it can do effectively what that application can do. But remember, as I said, the operating system does not let the applications do a lot because the application is fundamentally mistrusted. But at that point of time, the malignant software is actually running on its memory. So phase two, and this is where things get really, really, this is where it's really difficult for them to do it. And that's why it's not always possible. Sometimes they're just not able to execute this part. But then they use your operating system vulnerabilities, which are even more expensive, to then essentially pivot from application compromise to your operating system compromise. So what they then do is they bypass, it's a process known as jailbreaking or rooting your operating system, your mobile operating system. And once it does that, it can disable all the app protection. So it's like, just to think of it in terms of war terms, so somebody gets a beachhead. So there's a castle that you have, somebody goes in, burrows in, gets into a wall, uses that wall to then dig a hole, and then at the other end, they go and open the main gate. So once they open the main gate, that means everything can then come in. And so, but these tools are very careful not to have an army march in through your front door, because they know that, you know, if your phone suddenly starts consuming more power, starts getting warmed up, or, you know, you find other apps that you didn't download on your screen, you will notice. And so they are very, some of their most insidious technology is the way they hide their presence inside the app. So they first need to break into an app. Then they need to break into an operating system. And then they need to stay silent and invisible within your system so that you don't notice that they're there. And then they need to attain whatever their objective is. So in this case, what they do is then they essentially, once they have operating system access, they essentially do what's known as a man-in-the-middle attack, in the sense that they don't change what's in WhatsApp. They don't want to change even a line of code in WhatsApp, but they just sit between the communication that goes in through the operating system to WhatsApp. Remember, when you're typing something, you're not typing it directly into WhatsApp. You're typing it into the keyboard application of the operating system, which interprets your keystrokes and then sends it to the application which is listening, which has registered its interest in listening to your keystrokes. All I need to do is, once I have operating system control, I just need to listen. I'm just another app which is listening to whatever it is you're typing in WhatsApp. Similarly, when WhatsApp is displaying something to you on the phone, it's not displaying it itself. It is sending the data to the operating system, which is then essentially painting your screen with that message. Again, the attacker is sitting right in the operating system. So whatever is being reflected on the screen, they get to see it. So it's not as if they change WhatsApp or they change any of your other messaging apps. So this means that whatever encryption you have there, it cannot prevent them from seeing what you're typing. They're essentially looking over your shoulder at that point of time in a very unobtrusive fashion. So the question that I sometimes get is, what can somebody do in order to prevent themselves from being surveillanced or hacked? So one of the, I think the most important thing always is, really, honestly, if there are zero-day vulnerabilities present in the applications you're using, and somebody is motivated enough to spend millions of dollars to target you, then there's often very little you can do. That is unfortunately true. But what you should absolutely do is you should always keep, first of all, you should very much limit the apps you use on your phone. You should only use apps that you use regularly and that come from very reputable vendors. So I know there's often a tendency. So sometimes, you know, you're basically, let's say you're, and I do, so I'm taking a metro, and there's there's a much better, you know, I could open it in a browser and look at the timetable, but there's an app. Just download the app. It's just much simpler. So I download the app, but I ensure that once the ride is finished, I remove that. So remove apps. Don't have apps on your phone that you are not using and that do not really, I'm not saying that these apps are malicious in themselves, but these apps might have zero-day vulnerabilities that are very easy to find, because again, it's not a lot of security testing that's gone on while making these apps. So remove apps that you know are made by, you know, they're not commonly downloaded. And again, if you're security conscious, look at the publisher of whatever it is you're downloading on your app. Remember, everything that you download on your phone is a conduit for attackers to come into your phone. And perhaps the most important thing that you can do to secure yourself against malware and surveillance is to ensure that you have the latest operating system patches downloaded. Remember, your main protection is not the apps. It is your protection is the operating system. So always, always, and I know it's sometimes a pain to, and this is particularly true for laptops, to reboot your machine whenever a new update is available. So many people do not download the latest updates. It's like months, they're often months, sometimes years, out of sync with the latest updates. Do not do that in this day and age. Many people say, oh, I don't want to download the latest update, it'll make my computer run slow. And that's true, it very well might. This is unfortunately where not enough criticism is given to operating system vendors, in that they deliberately, and this is unfortunately because the operating system vendor in many cases in the mobile phone is your hardware vendor, right? So Apple is the operating system vendor, and they're the also the guys who are selling you the phone. So they are effectively incentivized to ensure that their software essentially makes your hardware obsolete so that you have to buy another hardware. So there is a tendency of people not to download operating system updates because they know that, you know, that these companies, they intentionally in many ways just provide you a lot more every operating system to make your existing hardware run increasingly slow. And then you say, okay, you know what, I'm just going to upgrade to the latest iPhone. But what happens as a concomitant of this is that people are just very, very reluctant to update their phone, especially to new major version numbers of operating systems. And you have to always remember that when many of these operating system vendors, they provide patches for zero-day vulnerabilities, they don't necessarily go and announce the fact. You know, when vulnerabilities get announced and they are provided a CVE number and they're kept in the National Vulnerability Database, usually those vulnerabilities are vulnerabilities being found out by somebody else outside the company. And they reported it to the company, at which point of time most companies have to make a public disclosure of it. But there are many things that they find out among themselves, and they don't publicize those things at all. And they don't have to. So they have bug. So just when the reason why I'm saying this is because sometimes you'll see what is the change log of this new update that has come on your phone, and it doesn't have anything about cybersecurity. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't any cybersecurity fix there. So the point is always, always, and I cannot stress this enough, always be updated with the latest version of your mobile phone operating system as well as your laptop, but specifically your mobile phone, because of the amount of, like, most of our daily transactions now happen on the mobile phone. I have a desktop at home, and it's often weeks that I don't open my desktop, which I cannot believe, you know, 5 years ago. Because everything now I do on my phone. So that's it. That's it for today. And I will be back next week. Until then, everybody, stay well. Bye-bye.